This is the Yes to Life show, a show dedicated to the subject of integrative medicine for cancer, which you can translate to mean any sort of medicine that might help in any way, in body, mind or spirit. We're currently in the middle of a series of shows focused on our forthcoming book, The Cancer Revolution, which has been written by integrative medicine expert Patricia Peat and 37 other international experts. It's a book all about integrative medicine for cancer, or integrative oncology, and it inevitably has a complete section dedicated to nutrition, an extremely important topic for our times of depleted, chemical-laden industrial foods. Poor nutrition serves us with a double whammy, in that it's hard to buy anything in a supermarket that doesn't contain new-to-nature chemicals, often known carcinogens or cancer-causing substances. Combine this with an often shockingly low nutritional content and you have a recipe for disaster, as the nutrients required to process and excrete the toxins simply aren't there. Sad to say, buying really good food has become a complex and specialised subject these days. Following any of the convenient paths to shopping and cooking devised for us by industry simply won't do it. The rising tide of chronic health conditions in the West are a testament to where convenience leads. Today I shall be talking to two of the expert contributors to the cancer revolution, Linda Brown and Patricia Daly. No, she's not a relative. Linda is an award-winning cookery and food writer. One of her best-known books is The Shopper's Guide to Organic Food and Farming, and she was, for many years, actively involved in the organic movement. She has contributed a foundational chapter called How to Buy Good Food. I'm talking to her at her home in Stroud over Skype. So, hi Linda, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
It's my pleasure.
Great. So your chapter, which I absolutely love, is called How to Buy Good Food. And it sounds deceptively simple. And many people might wonder how you managed to actually fill up a whole chapter on this. But meanwhile, I imagine that you could, in fact, easily fill a book on the subject. So why is buying good food such a complex matter these days?
It's a complex matter because the food industry as a whole is a very complex beast these days. Once upon a time, I think buying food was very simple. We only had real food. We only had local food providers, and we didn't have this whole global food supply, or indeed these great big air hangers full of food that actually most of us are never going to eat, but nevertheless it's there. We think we should be eating it. We have a whole pile of advertising coming our way, desperately persuading us that ready meals is the new thing, or this ingredient is the new thing. That's all wrapped up inside a building called a supermarket. The food business these days is a monumentally mega billion buck, whatever it is, global enterprise. Sadly, there are huge bucks to be made from processed food. And so it goes on. And that's before we even enter into this ridiculous game we seem to have got in called nutritional advice. Mm. So even once you've chosen your food, you've then got to go through the whole packaging thing and the whole labeling thing.
Yes.
And labels these days are actually designed either to confuse you or to hoodwink you. Okay. So, for example, you will have a label on a packet of dried beans saying cholesterol-free. It never had cholesterol in the first place.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And
so, you know, by the time you add all that lot up, I think that is why buying food has become so complex. And by the way, we haven't even begun to talk about how food is produced. Mm. But actually, I think we can genuinely simplify that right down. I think if we go back to basics, we understand a few of the basic questions that we need to check in order to be able to buy ourselves good value food, by which I mean food that will nourish us, not just kind of fill a hole for 5 minutes, then actually you don't really have to worry about all the rest.
Right, okay. So I'd like to get a kind of sense of how important certain criteria are to you personally, talking about how the food is made. I mean, how much do you personally insist that the food you buy is organic?
I don't insist that it's organic, although I probably myself buy, I would say, a good 90% organic. Mm. But I absolutely insist that I make sure that every piece of food I buy, I understand how it has been produced. Very occasionally, because I am a human being, I too can't resist a bag of tomatoes, say, for a quid, a bag of ripe tomatoes for a quid. Hmm. But then again, I would buy those if they were English tomatoes, because, for example, these days I know that English tomato growers tend to use biological controls in their glasshouses. It's now first-line choice. I would actually be a bit more circumspect, for example, about buying probably tomatoes from Spain for various reasons, and there's lots of good stuff that comes out from Spain, by example. So basically, I make each food decision I make on an individual basis. If sometimes I drop through the net, so to speak, at least I know why. Mm-hmm. I don't beat myself up about it, but it happens very rarely. I do it for a specific reason, usually because I know I can peel the skins off the tomatoes, or if I buy red peppers, for example, those lovely Hungarian wax ones, I manage to get those cheaply, I will roast them and I will always take the skins off.
Mm. So you're incredibly well informed to be able to make those kind of decisions about the provenance of your food. I don't claim to know anything like you do about where food's come from and how it's been made. So I kind of rely on labels like organic in order to help me choose which to go for.
Oh, I think labels like organic is absolutely a safety net. So if you are not interested, and that's kind of fair enough, or you feel you don't have the time, etc., etc., then organic is absolutely, for me, the label that everybody should try for, because it does provide that safety net. If you do buy food which is labelled organic, that means it's certified organic. That means you are guaranteed that it has been produced in a way that you can feel comfortable with. And it certainly will not have any of the it will not have any of the harmful pesticides on it. And you can be sure that the meat will have been raised in pretty good ways as well.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is comforting that that exists, because without that, I'd say we'd all have to become experts like you.
Well, if I may, Robin, I don't actually see it that way. I really don't. I've been interested in food. I worked out, I think when I was about 8, that you are what you eat. Okay. And I have been interested in food ever since then. But I am not the kind of person that swats up all day. And actually, I don't think you need to know that much. Firstly, I really don't think. I think, you know, there's a few basic questions. And armed with those few basic questions, it's a bit like knowing your tables. You know, it's a bit like knowing your 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times
table. Okay. It's sort of priorities of what's the most important?
It is priorities. But then the other thing I would like to say, if I may, is that, to be honest, taking charge of your own nourishment, for me, is immensely empowering. Mm. It really does enrich your life, and it's actually really interesting. And the easiest way to get to understand how food is produced is, for example, to go to a farmer's market, because there you can meet the producer. First of all, you have a really nice time because you're talking to another human being.
Yep.
Secondly, slowly but surely, you can kind of find out how they grow their stuff, and you can then build up for yourself what matters for you. So, yes, I am an expert in the sense that food has been my profession for an awful long time. But believe you me, there are a hell of a lot more people who've got a lot more knowledge than me, but I have enough knowledge for my own needs. And I would encourage everybody to do that. Because it's good fun, actually.
Right, right. And probably no better way to actually to enhance the relationship you're talking about with your food than to grow some of your own, of course.
Oh, yeah, very definitely. I used to at one time literally be self-sufficient. But these days I have a small garden. I live on my own, but I always grow something for myself, because that absolutely keeps that link alive, and it really wakes up your taste buds. Because if you grow your own lettuce, you begin to understand what a lettuce can taste like.
Right.
And that, again, it's like a kind of explosion. It just lights something up in your head. And you also begin, I think, to have a much more mindful connection with your food, a much more spiritual connection with your food. But I don't necessarily mean, you know, spinning off into the cosmic or whatever. But
okay.
I think you have a deeper understanding and a deeper gratefulness for food.
Mm. Great. All right. So beyond organic, you've got biodynamic. Is that something you indulge in personally? Or?
Oh, yes. As it happens, funnily enough, I've just become a trustee of the Biodynamic Association.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that I had a reasonably good handle on what biodynamic farming and growing and gardening was all about. But I have discovered that I have literally only just scratched the surface. And if you can, we have a few pockets of biodynamic hotspots in the country. And if anybody can ever get to a biodynamic farm, for example, over in Sussex, there's Tablehurst Farm and Plawhatch Farm. The Camphill communities are all biodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is a hugely gratifying experience, because the biodynamic is organic farming, but it's organic farming with an extra dimension. So the biodynamic mission in life is actually to constantly improve the health and vitality of the food, and to do that, of the food and the animals, and to do that, it employs all of nature's forces. So that's why it will use, for example, the lunar calendar, which in fact is just common sense when you think about it. So it adds an extra dimension to food.
Mm, well, the little experience I've had of actually eating it, I was impressed.
Good, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Mm.
There is just an extra kind of indefinable something there.
I think so. Okay, so there's a huge diversity of views on what the best diet, both when it comes to avoiding cancer and chronic illness and recovering from them. But as time goes by, I find that I'm veering more and more strongly towards the view that it's, as often as not, it's not so much to do with the food as to what's been done to it. For example, you know, milk has had a great deal of bad press, especially around cancer, and for a good reason. But, of course, modern milk relates very little to the milk of 100 years ago that was a staple of so many nationalities. What do you think about this?
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think milk is a perfect example. So, first of all, raw milk is a totally fabulous food.
Mm.
It really is. Now, once you pasteurize the milk, you're actually killing off all the beneficial bacteria. Then it enables you to collect milk in great big tankers, which means it doesn't matter if you've got some milk there of inferior quality, because it all gets lumped together. It all gets pasteurized, which basically gets the life knocked out of it. It then, these days, don't ask me why, but these days it then gets homogenized homogenize, which is yet a further processing, a further hit of processing. It then gets carted all around the country before it finally arrives on your doorstep, or rather in your supermarket backs. And I think that is entirely true. I would recommend, I personally am so lucky where I live now because I live near Stroud. So I actually have a local organic dairy. So I would never drink milk that's, I only ever drink full fat milk, non-homogenized, organic. If I can get raw, that is like the creme de la creme. And as for the rest, I personally don't touch it. And I'm a very healthy human being. I don't need to worry about my health in that way, touch wood. But I personally wouldn't touch the other stuff because I don't even consider it nourishing food.
I think, you know, it seems that a lot of the things that they've actually done to increase the milk yields by a phenomenal amount are the other area, which is completely questionable, and means that, you know, even before they're producing milk, the cows are not in good condition.
No, of course not. I mean, I don't know how many women would feel being put on this earth to knock out 20 kids, whether they liked it or not.
Right.
But, it's when you look at it that way, it is not a pleasant life for many dairy cows. But, of course, we come back to the usual problem. So none of us like the way, for example, most of our milk is produced. We don't like that, but everybody wants cheap milk.
Yeah.
Every time you buy any food which has been industrially produced, you are paying a very heavy price for it. It's just you're not actually paying for it with your pennies, so to speak. You're paying for it in other ways. And that's before, by the way, we get on to the difference between a cow's natural diet and what they're fed on now.
Yes.
And then they're propped up with the antibiotics, etc., etc. And meanwhile, you are drinking the results of that every day. Now, for me, that's all this is kind of very easy for me to say. I only live on my own, so I don't have to support myself. But I have always taken the approach I would rather have less of good quality food than more bad quality food.
Right, so makes complete sense.
Cut my cloth accordingly. If I have milk, that's the milk I want to eat. Otherwise, I won't bother having milk. For me, that's not a problem.
Right. Okay.
It's
so,
choices.
Sorry.
It's all about choices. So for me, the whole of the food debate and how you nurture yourself is all about choices. And I think if you try and make the best choices for you most of the time, then that is a huge leap towards keeping yourself well in body, mind and spirit, because all of that lot is so linked together, as we know.
Yeah, well, that's actually the kind of the area I wanted to talk about to finish off with. Is this it's a big subject, but the importance of the relationship between the food choice we make and our overall well-being. And it's not just our physical well-being, is it? It's our psychological and emotional well-being, because, you know, what if we go out there and shop and buy the cheapest stuff we can find every time for our food shopping, what does that say about our relationship to ourselves?
Absolutely. It basically says you don't love yourself, is what it says. It basically says that you're only worth shoving a pile of rubbish down you.
Right.
That is what it says. Now, if you look at the other extreme of that, there is so much work out there. When you put love into that food, your food, that changes it completely, and that actually changes it. And funnily enough, I'm just kind of beginning to understand quantum physics. Bear with me,
okay,
a second on this. But I think that anybody listening who has read, for example, The Field by Lynn McTaggart, and what quantum physics does is given explanation for how the observer has an effect on the observed. Mm-hmm. In other words, what you believe, you know, really is true. And so the way you approach your food and the way you approach yourself, and that has an enormous effect, I think, on our health. But it does all start with the food. Interestingly enough, Rudolf Steiner, who basically founded the biodynamic movement, now, he was this kind of odd mixture of being... you know, he was a scientist and a spiritualist and an esotericist and interested in alchemy and all the ancient's wisdom.
It's what you call a polymath, I think.
Yeah, totally polymath. And, yeah. And obviously one of the leading intellectuals of his day.
Yes.
But what happened was the leading farmers of the day came and thinkers of the day came up to him and said, look, we've noticed that our soil fertility is declining and our seeds aren't as fertile. Would you please have some thoughts on this? So he gave this series of lectures, his series of 8 agricultural lectures. And his analysis was, and they also said, and look, you know, we've noticed that spiritually, human beings are not in a good place. We're now talking 1920s, by the way. Mm. And he said, look, what is happening? He said that the quality of our food is deteriorating so fast that it cannot give us the nutrition which will give us the spirituality that human beings need. Mm. That is why what you eat ultimately is so important to your overall well-being. And I thought that was quite interesting because it's the perfect example of how body, mind and spirit are connected.
Mm. Right. Well, of course, that's another section of the book. It's not the nutrition section, the mind-body section, but of course, it's all one thing, really. Where it's this is the thing about integrative medicine. It's actually acknowledging the interconnectedness of everything.
Yes.
Therefore, the stupidity of trying to address illness as being just one thing that went wrong in the body.
I agree completely.
Mm. All right. Well, look, lovely to talk to you today, Linda, and huge thanks from me for contributing to the Cancer Revolution. It's you know, it's people like you who've given of yourself freely that have made this thing possible. It would never have happened otherwise. So a big, big thank you to you.
Oh, that's my pleasure, and if I may say so. I've, from what I've seen of the book, it looks really great. It really does. I think an awful lot of people are going to enjoy reading it and will get huge amounts from it too. I sincerely hope so.
Great. Thank you very much, Linda.
Well, I hope the musical accompaniment that snuck in there at times didn't distract too much from a great interview. My next guest, Patricia Daly, has become an authority on the ketogenic diet, a technique that has been an approved treatment for epilepsy for decades, but more recently has attracted some serious scientific as well as personal interest in the field of cancer. Patricia herself became interested due to her own situation and found it so successful that she has become a specialist and author on the subject of ketogenics and cancer. I'm talking to her at her home in Ireland by Skype.
So, Patricia, like many people who are drawn to study some aspect of nutrition, yours is both a personal and a professional story. You have your own story to tell about cancer and about the very particular choices that have led to your long-term health. So probably central to these choices has been the ketogenic diet, which you've become a bit of an authority on and which you generously contributed material about for the Cancer Revolution. So could you start off by telling us what you think the potential is for the ketogenic diet as an approach to cancer if it were to become widely adopted?
Yeah, thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me on this show. It's great. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's as you said just earlier, it's sort of the last 2 to 3 years, the ketogenic diet has become a bit of a buzzword almost. And although we have had this information for quite a long time, but it's thanks to researchers like... you know, in Germany, Dr. Coy, Professor Kammerer as well. And then in the States, Dominic D'Agostino, Tom Seyfried, Adrian Scheck, all those brilliant people who are really putting a lot of effort into it. Colin Champ is brilliant as well. And the more research, obviously, we have, and it is interesting that almost every study is very pro-keto, it seems to. Just recently, a pilot study came out as well on polycystic ovary syndrome. There's more and more coming out on cancer, obviously, and, you know, hyperglycemia, sort of constantly elevated blood sugars, what effects that has on cancer patients. And we do have quite a bit of evidence. I was listening to the interview with Rob Thomas recently, the UK oncologist, and as he says, I mean, how much more evidence do you need? I mean, the human trials are underway now for keto and cancer, but we won't have the results, I'd say, for another 3 or 4 years, because it's incredibly challenging to recruit patients for those studies and to make sure they comply. Compliance is a huge issue and a confounding factor. So anything that can, you know, make them feel different, not just diet. That's obviously all the challenges we have in the nutrition world. But yes, there is more and more research that shows, in particular for cancer and the ketogenic diet, if you manage your insulin, if you manage your blood glucose, it has huge benefits, not only for people who manage cancer, but potentially also for people who are going through chemo and radio. And I think that's where the big hope lies as well, that we can really start to bridge the gap between conventional and complementary therapies, that there are studies showing how it basically makes the job of oncologists easier. And I think that's what we all want. And we're not suggesting this is an alternative therapy. I mean, in some cases, it has to be, because there is no alternative in the conventional world. So I come across cases like these. But quite often, the ketogenic diet or a low-carb approach even can really be successfully used to reduce side effects and to enhance the effects of conventional treatments. And I think that's where the big potential of the ketogenic diet lies, and also to some extent in prevention, in my opinion.
Right. Yes, it does hold out a hope of bridging that gap, as you say, because of the fact that it actually is a conventional treatment already, just not for cancer.
Yeah, for epilepsy, it's been used for a long, long time. That's how actually the ketogenic diet was created or discovered. It was in the early 1900s when doctors realized that epileptic patients actually stopped having seizures when they were sick, and they did forced fasting. So they realized, oh, wow, these patients are having less seizures or complete absence of seizures. So that made them think, OK, is there a dietary approach? Because we obviously can't put them on a lifelong fast, a dietary approach that can mimic fasting and can bring them all the benefits. And that's how, that was the first, one of the first applications apart from weight management in treatment of epilepsy.
All right, so could you just summarize your own story and what led you to focus on the ketogenic diet?
Yeah, I mean, to cut a very long story short, it was 2008. I was initially diagnosed with a very rare form of eye cancer. It's a melanoma, so it's a quite a, it was a very aggressive and fast growing cancer tumor sitting in my eyeball, actually. And then at the time, I really didn't have any knowledge into medical approaches. So I did all the conventional treatments. I had surgery twice, and I had plaque radiotherapy over in Liverpool in the UK, because the type of cancer is so rare, there was no treatment available in Ireland where I was based. So treatment were successful at the beginning, and the tumour shrank very quickly. But then only about 20 months later, I was diagnosed with a relapse, and the tumour had almost doubled in size again. It was rapidly growing, so I had to have more surgery and proton beam therapy that time. And then in 2012, so that was 2 years after the relapse, things were just not looking good again. I mean, the eye was basically a mess. I mean, when I look at the pictures, there was everything. There was cataracts, there was edema, so swelling. And I had a lot of problems with excess blood vessels, so enhanced angiogenesis was going on. I had vision loss from side effects of the radiotherapy. And we weren't quite sure if the tumour actually was really dead or if there was any activity. So they suggested that I'd either do Avastin injection, so to inhibit angiogenesis, so that the blood vessel growth, or that the other option would be to take the eye out. And I basically said, look, I'm so young. I was only 32 at the time. I had two kids, two very young kids. And I said, I'm going to try my own third option. And thank goodness the consultant agreed to give me a bit of time. Mm-hmm. If I just had to go, the condition was that I had to go in every 3 weeks to monitor the eye. And if anything would go out of control, we would obviously have to take steps immediately to, yeah, injections or taking the eye out, another operation. But it was literally, I had had an eye on the ketogenic diet for months before that already. And I was, okay, now is the time. Now I just have to jump. And I was a qualified nutritional therapist at the time already.
Oh, you were? Right.
Yeah. I had started in a month after finishing treatment in 2008. So I qualified in 2011. So I had the confidence, although there was hardly any information around, to actually just do it. And I had nothing to lose, absolutely nothing to lose. So 3 weeks later, the consultant looked into my eye and basically said, did you get a Avastin injection somewhere? I mean, the effect was just so visible.
3 weeks, amazing.
I mean, it was a matter of weeks. It was, really amazing. And he said, OK, you seem to at the moment be out of the danger zone. They call it the danger zone. And just keep going and we keep monitoring. And that's what I've been doing ever since 2012. And now my vision is nearly back to normal, although in 2010, it was clear that within 18 months I would lose my vision. The eye is very calm. Everything is going fine. And the interesting thing as well, and I only just realized that last December 2015, that I had an extraocular tumor as well, because a lot of people were saying, oh, well, you did have your conventional treatments. Maybe it was the effects of the conventional treatments and not just the ketogenic diet. Mm-hmm. But I did have an extraocular tumor as well that nobody talked about, but it was in my files. And I read through that, and that was unchanged in 2012, the extraocular tumour. It was fairly large as well.
So this is sitting next to your eyeball?
It was next to the optic nerve, basically, on the eyeball, so outside the eye. The other one is the main tumour is inside, and then the spread is outside. So it spreads to outside the eye, so local spread. And I just by complete coincidence discovered that last December. And I said to my consultant, goodness, we haven't monitored that for 3 years. It just got completely forgotten. And there was slight panic. I did a CT scan immediately, brain CT, and the tumor is completely gone. Mm-hmm. There's no sign of scar tissue or lesion or tumor, no nothing. And that was really in 2012, even after radiotherapy, it was unchanged. It literally just didn't respond to radiotherapy at all in terms of size and shape. So for me, that sort of, it was another amazing testimonial for the ketogenic diet. So
absolutely. Mm. And how's your consultant about it all?
He's very supportive. He helps with, I do abdomen ultrasounds regularly to see if there's no kidney stones, if my liver is doing okay, if everything is fine in my gut, just functionally, structurally. And I do regular blood tests as well. So he supports me in that way behind the scenes. But he basically, his attitude is, look, I can't really talk about this publicly, or because there's just the lack of RCTs. Randomized controlled trials, so the solid clinical trials, and I sort of get that, but it is disappointing. Yeah,
frustrating. Okay, so could you just tell us in simple terms, people who don't know what the ketogenic diet is, what it is exactly and what it sets out to achieve and why?
Yeah, I mean, basically what the main goal we want to achieve with the ketogenic diet is teach the body to burn fat instead of glucose. So our body is like almost a little bit like a hybrid engine. So we can switch between glucose or sugar burning and fat burning. It's not like a car where it's either petrol or diesel. We can, healthy people have the metabolic flexibility, as we call it, to switch back and forth. Mm-hmm. So for instance, a healthy person who is sleeping at night, who doesn't eat too late at night or high sugar meal at night, should be in very light ketosis in the morning. That's just what happens if we fast for a prolonged period of time as well. And so that's what we're basically trying to teach our body to do most of the time. And for cancer in particular, we do know now that cancer cells are extremely, or it depends a bit on the type of cancer, but many of them, they really like glucose. That's their favorite food. There's also a few other things they can use in terms of amino acids, but glucose is the main thing. That's why PET scans are being used as well for diagnostic tools. So we're trying to really reduce that glucose in the blood and reduce that favorite food of the cancer cells. And what we also know is that cancer cells struggle to use ketones or fatty acids to generate energy. And as you probably know, I mean, cancer cells need constant energy and oxygen because they are growing all the time and they're proliferating. So they do need substrates and substance to grow. And if you, make that, even if you, I mean, cutting it off completely is, in some cases, is unrealistic. But even if you reduce it drastically, you just make a cancer cell's life a lot harder. They start to struggle and they start to become more vulnerable. And I've also seen in some people, it reversed chemo resistance.
Right.
So that's quite interesting as well. That's they.
Yeah, very important. So this is where it comes as a great treatment adjunct to other treatments which are actually attacking the cancer. It weakens them, ready to be taken out by another treatment.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, is the ketogenic diet useful for anyone with cancer, or are there particular types that stand to benefit more than others?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that, or the important thing is to look at the PET scan, if somebody has a PET scan. So you can tell from a PET scan how glucose avid a tumour is. And they have certain, not ratings, but they have certain measures as well where they can tell you, okay, the glucose uptake is really much higher than the glucose uptake of a healthy cell, for instance.
Right.
So in that case, for me, it's the ketogenic diet is the first port of call, basically. So that's what I use with, you know, brain tumors, for instance, as well. I literally think it's a no-brainer to even just give it a go and see how the patient responds. And obviously, if it can be implemented, it depends on so many different factors.
Yes.
But there's other types then of tumors where, for instance, the PET scan isn't approved for prostate cancer by the FDA because prostate cancer, especially the very slow growing, wouldn't really show up, or it's just a different type, a slightly different type of cancer as well, depending on how fast growing the cells are. There are some aggressive types of prostate cancer, but yeah, the fact that the PET scan isn't approved for prostate shows me that maybe it's not the first port of call. It depends also how somebody is doing already, what diet they're on when they see me. And if a ketogenic diet goes too far for some people, and obviously also if they go through treatment. But I'd say it's worth considering for all cancer patients. I think everybody should just consider it as an option. Get the support they need, and especially then really implement it properly. And it needs to be well designed to avoid nutrient deficiencies.
Mm. Okay, so just to round off, I think maybe a lot of people have a hard time envisaging just what an ultra low carb diet might look like, and hence the reason that we got you to share some of your tasty looking recipes in the Cancer Revolution. But can you give us an idea of what a day's meal choices might look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question because a lot of people ask, so do you just drink olive oil all day? Like, how do you get 80%, 75 to 80%, sometimes even more of your calories from fat? How do you do that? So yeah, there's lots of different options. So in the morning, a typical breakfast could be it could be an egg-based breakfast for people who tolerate eggs. So you know, scrambled eggs in olive oil, scrambled in olive oil or coconut oil with a bit of spinach, for instance, or sometimes I have other leftover vegetables and some smoked salmon, for instance. What I need to emphasize as well is ketogenic diets are not high protein. Okay. I mentioned earlier cancer cells can use certain amino acids as well, and especially a lot if you have an excess amount of protein, we can turn that into glucose in the liver as well. So it's important to keep that in mind too, and not just eat loads of eggs and meat and fish, and that needs to be kept an eye on as well. And then lunch could be, in my case, it's usually leftovers. So I always have some fresh leaves, green leafy vegetables, and that's very important that we include the vegetables as well. And it could be, for instance, some smoked mackerel. I quite like that. And sometimes in the winter when it's very cold, I have some bone broth and I just throw in some fish and some vegetables and leftovers, maybe a bit of seaweed and lots of spices and herbs. So it takes me about 3 to 5 minutes to make that. And dinner then can be, there's loads of different options. One of my favourites is, you know, salmon, oily fish, and baking that in the oven with broccoli and cauliflower rice, for instance. That could be an option. And always obviously adding fat and or focusing on the fatty cuts of meat, for instance, as well. You know, duck is great as well, and eating the skin, chicken thighs, and then also the fatty cuts of lamb, so lamb shoulder. That's really good. And for me, very important, I eat organ meat. So I eat liver and kidneys and brain on a very regular basis, because they are full of B vitamins, which we can lack on a ketogenic diet because there's no grains. So it can be a bit tricky to get the B vitamins in.
And what are you advising your vegetarians to do in the face of this? Obviously, meat's a great place to go for this.
Yeah, it is possible to go vegetarian on a ketogenic diet. It's not something I actively encourage, but if somebody comes and asks and says, look, for ethical or whatever other reasons, I don't want to eat meat and fish, I obviously accept that. But I do encourage people then to have, for instance, eggs as well. And, you know, dairy is possible to incorporate as well in certain amounts. And yeah, it's possible by incorporating also obviously all the other protein sources, and having you know, avocados are great as well. So it's possible. It's a bit more work, and but because protein isn't a massive part of the diet, I don't usually see a big problem. But again, we can. I do consider, you know, meat and organ meat and fish as a very, very important, it's almost like a condiment. It's not a huge part of the diet, but it is an important part still, because especially if it's well designed and there are some excellent nutrients in some of the, especially organ meats, but also other animal products that I wouldn't really want to miss.
Right. Yeah. Okay, that's great. Well, thank you very much, Patricia, and thank you so much for your contribution, your valuable contribution to the cancer revolution, which is really appreciated.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, of course, yeah. Anything to spread the information.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that dip into the nutrition section of the cancer revolution. There's much more in the book, all presented in the most accessible way. If you're interested to order the book, go to thecancerrevolution.co.uk and sign up to receive details of when and where to order. To find out more about the charity Yes to Life, go to yestolife.org.uk, and there you can also find links to resources mentioned in today's show by clicking Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and then choosing UK Health Radio. If you've got any comments you'd like to share about today's show, you can tweet us at CancerRev, at Yes to Life, or at RMK_daily. Or visit our Facebook pages for Yes to Life, for the Cancer Revolution, or for me, Robin Daly. Next week, we'll be carrying on our journey talking to more people who've contributed to the cancer revolution. I hope you'll be able to join me again. Goodbye.